catch Talking Heads frontman David Byrne live at Boston's Museum of Science on May 8th. David will be appearing to talk about what for centuries scientists and philosophers have called the eel question. Much of these mysterious creatures' life cycle remains a mystery even in our advanced scientific age. David will be joined by perhaps our greatest cultural authority on the eel question, Patrick Svensson, author of the acclaimed Book of Eels. Limited tickets remain, so please get yours at singforscience.org/events.
It turns out, when you listen to music, if there's a singer, the voice of the singer activates your own facial system. Even if you do not sing along with the singer, your brain that controls your facial expression is automatically activated. So this is one of the collateral benefits we learned from a Parkinson research program with music. You know, initially we just want to train their walking, is that right? We didn't realize that actually the music can activate their facial muscles automatically. So over time, not only their walking, but also their facial expression is substantially improved.
Welcome to Sing for Science, the show where musicians and scientists talk about music and science. I'm your host, Matt White. Each week, we'll talk about a song by our guest artist and how it connects with our guest scientist's area of expertise. This week, I'm delighted to have opera soprano Renee Fleming and neuroscientist Dr. Bin Hu on the show. As part of her role as artistic advisor at large to the Kennedy Center, Renee has spearheaded a collaboration with the National Institutes of Health that brings attention to research and practice at the intersection of music, health, and neuroscience. The title of this week's episode on the show is Ave Maria, Healing the Brain Through the Power of Music. Hi, Renee and Bin. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi. Hi, man. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Renee, I thought Ave Maria would be a good song for us to discuss on the show because being that it's a prayer or an appeal for help, I think it exemplifies a lot of the work that you've been doing at the intersection of music and medicine with music in the mind. Is that fair to say?
It is. I mean, you know, our most primal response to music is an emotional one. And that's incredibly important. And it's something that we all crave right now. And we crave connection. And music is one of the best vehicles for that.
Yeah, of course. I'm sure this is a song that you've sung thousands of times in your career. I wanted to ask, what's the context in which you're most often asked to perform Ave Maria?
So I've sung it in the context of both recitals with piano, but also as a kind of a prayer and something that's iconic. It's one of probably five songs that everyone around the world responds powerfully to and has taken it on as their own. It's really incredible when a song gets to that status.
I want to add, just earlier today, I was listening to a podcast interview with Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote a book that many people have recommended to me called Sapiens. And in talking about the intersection of medicine and religion, he pointed out that in the New Testament, the stories about Jesus have more to do with healing the sick than anything else. And that's something that had never occurred to me, and it's also relevant to how we're talking about this song.
It's been one of my favorite books in the last few years, just the way he kind of concisely puts together human development. And it's extraordinary. And there's so much from my education some decades ago that just doesn't match up with what people know now. So I was having one aha moment after another. But it is true. It is interesting that it was healing that was a foundation of Christianity.
To me, this is one of those songs that the melody, the lyrics, the harmonic movement, you know, in the accompaniment, it's all so complementary and it works together so perfectly. And I feel like the music is also expressing what I feel like the prayer is trying to express, that I thought that might be a good opportunity to talk about what neuroscience can tell us about instances of harmony or consonance or dissonance for that matter.
Yeah. So there are brain imaging, you know, studies to look at the consonant versus deconsonant sound, how they activate brain. They're very different. So for music perception. Actually, there is a high level map in the cortex that is devoted to particular elements of music. So this is what we know. Actually, there is a large number of studies. It is the most active area of arts and neuroscience. That's the music research.
And pardon me, where in the brain physically is the cortex?
Oh, it's like a cap. It's most on the surface, on your brain surface. It's called cortex.
So it's the entire surface of the brain.
Yeah. So you see those gyrus, you know, those curves, you know, when you see this picture, those are the cortex. They're folding. They're like paper, right? It's a piece of tissue, but they fold it. So if you stretch out entire cortex, it could be something like 10 meters wide.
You know? And could you explain, how do we interpret data in neuroscience and in brain imaging? Is it, you know, are we looking for increased blood flow? Is it electrical activity? What is the finest point of data we can analyze in the brain at this point?
For humans, there are three categories. Is that right? One is you measure blood flow changes. Sometimes we call them bold signals because whenever there's activity, the oxygen level changes. So you can pick up the oxygen level change through a magnetic field. So that's just a functional MRI. That's okay. Essentially there is that signal. Yeah, the second method is electrophysiology, which you can record, either use a probe to get inside brain in the patients undergoing surgery. For example, Parkinson's patients, implement a brain pacemaker. So actually you can insert your electrodes. Mm. Same for the epilepsy patient. You can record them and then you can ask a human to perform a task. So then you can find out which area is doing what, right? And the last one, I think these are most common used, is called PET scanning, post electrotomography. So that is very unique because you can inject a chemical in the brain, So if your activity causes changes of brain chemistry, and you can visualize it using this technology.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that the way that neurons speak with each other is they will release a neurotransmitter and it will be absorbed by the other neuron. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And so is that something that you can actually see with the measurement tech that we have now?
Yes. Yes. You're talking about the transmitter, then that's the PET. That's technology. You can label that transmitter.
Okay.
Either could be a glutamate or could be a dopamine, especially dopamine that responds to music. So you can actually follow where these transmitters appeared and disappeared. No.
Okay. Wild. Renee, how do you experience listening to music versus performing music?
Well, they're two different things. Although performing, I'm also listening.
Of course.
I'm also experiencing the music because I want to transfer my own connection and emotional response to what it is I'm performing to the audience. But when I listen to music now, it's for work. Mm-hmm. It's either because I'm learning things, which I'm typically doing all the time, or it's for pleasure. You know, and the listening for pleasure is typically more passive for me. But it's also, you know, I'm very often looking for a kind of a flow state. I'm looking for to be in the zone, to be calm. You know, sometimes if I'm working out or something, we often use music. Actually nowadays as a tool to get us into a certain state. You know, whether it's energetic because we have a lot to get done, maybe we're exercising. Or it's to calm down, it's to feel a little bit dreamy. The rhythm, I think it has a lot to do with our ability to have that sort of relaxation. People are now studying, you know, 40 hertz, for instance, as perhaps something that can really have a huge positive effect on the brain. I mean, amazing to think that there would be a non-invasive treatment based on vibration, for instance. That's one of the things that people are looking
for. So 40 hertz, you can't hear that, can you?
I think you can feel it.
Right.
You know, I experienced it at the MIT lab. You can definitely feel it. And they'll very often add higher partials to it so that you do get the sort of also the oral experience with it. But it's fascinating. And of course, lights can also be set to 40 hertz.
Oh, okay.
So the two together, you know, are potentially powerful.
And it feels what, relaxing?
It's mesmerizing, I would say. You know, it is definitely mesmerizing. And I mean, it's very, we rarely give ourselves the opportunity to stop and focus on something, or we're constantly multitasking, constantly having our attention drawn to, you know, bells and whistles, and very often quickly.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to kind of be in a booth and have just that vibration experience.
And it's emanating from what? A speaker?
Yeah, the vibration comes from a speaker. And of course, it can be set by a synthesizer, some sort of digital creation of sound. And I know Mickey Hart right now of the Grateful Dead is in California now working with Zakir Hussain. And they're very much interested in vibration. That's been his passion, actually. And he would use that lowest tones to kind of help his audience, and this is the Grateful Dead audience, mm-hmm. in a huge stadium, get into a trance state. Mm. And brilliant Rhiannon Giddens, the singer, said recently, was talking about, she's very much a historian, a music historian, and they were talking in performance about the fact that in, wasn't that long ago that in, you know, parts of Southern Italy and Greece and that part of the world, people used dance to heal.
Mm.
So, and it was really a trance type of dance that would go on sometimes for a week if someone was very ill.
Wow.
So there's a lot about our relationship to the natural world that we have forgotten. Mm. And scientists are beginning to look at this again.
Ben, what do you see if you're looking at the brain of someone who's performing versus someone who's listening to music?
I think Rene probably... it's the very few people who actually do have a brain image,
mm-hmm.
That when she was seeing. There was
the fMRI. I have an experiment at the NIH.
Yeah.
So I was in the machine for 2 hours, and they took images of me singing, speaking, and imagining singing. And it's on the website of the Kennedy Center and for our sound health project. And it's really fascinating because imagining singing had the most powerful effect on the brain. It affected more parts of the brain.
Yeah.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, the scientists who looked at the, were analyzing the images were surprised. And ultimately they said, well, okay, you're a singer. So singing for you is easy and you don't really have to think about it. So for another person, it probably would have been the strongest, garnered the strongest response. But for me, imagining singing took a little bit more effort because I had to tune out the sound of the machine and then there were multiple repetitions and et cetera. So that was the analysis in the end.
I would imagine that's because there's some amount of muscle memory that's going on.
Absolutely.
So there was a study actually to look at the so-called muscle memory, whatever, of a pianist. So if you learn a piece of music, you play it on the piano, you remember it, and then you go back into the scanner. If you just purely play that piece you just played, that was exactly the muscle that control that fingers, that area is activated. So it's probably similar to a singer, you know, the vocal
when you go in and imagine it.
No, you just listen. You just listen to that piece. You just play.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. So it's automatically brings out the muscle, entire muscle activity when you play.
Well, so listening experience is going to be entirely different for a musician who perhaps has some experience or relationship to the piece of music than someone else.
Oh, I'm pretty sure if somebody did a detailed analysis with a group of singers, you know, at the level of Renee, for example, there must be a very fundamental difference. You know, for accomplished pianist, so what we found out is actually there's way more white matter connecting the two sides of the brain.
What's white matter?
White matter is it's like fibers. Those are the wires that connect neurons. Okay, so you need those wires so that to send and receive the message.
And they only exist separating in between the two hemispheres, or is throughout the brain?
Whenever you have neurons that need to communicate to each other, they must go through the fibers, these axons, to send out the electrical pulse, and then to release the transmitter, okay? So there's long fibers, for example, from the cortex going to your leg muscle. And there's also short fibers just talking between neurons. So,
you know, it's really interesting. A few years ago, I learned a bunch of bossa nova music in Portuguese. And, you know, because I don't speak the language, I really had to drill it into my brain to the point that it was just completely, I was completely relying on muscle memory to perform this music. And I got a gig at this restaurant in the West Village for brunch, and that I was performing, like the tables were right in my space. And I would just pray that someone with a fascinating conversation would be seated next to me, because I was reliant so much on muscle memory that I couldn't help but tune out the experience of performing and be sucked into whatever was going on around me.
You know, I have to tell you, first of all, Portuguese is as hard as any language I've ever sung in. Huh. Because it is so hard. The diphthongs, which ones are nasal, it doesn't ever sound like it looks on the paper. I really struggled with it too. And there's no way to learn a language by rote and be able to sing it without it being in muscle memory. In my experience, whether in my case, it would have been Russian, Czech, some languages that I don't speak. And Portuguese is one of the most challenging.
Well, I find that very encouraging to hear you say
Yes,
that.
Don't feel bad.
Okay.
It's hard.
Renee, how do you experience singing by yourself versus singing with other people?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm almost always a solo artist, but I am singing with an orchestra typically, or with a pianist. And in an opera, sometimes there will be a duet or a trio or an ensemble of, you know, a number of singers. So you do have that experience, and it's really fun. It's the idea of listening and creating a sense of ensemble so that you want to be on the same page rhythmically. This is the purpose for the conductor. So the conductor is the one who will lead us and make sure that we're together. And sometimes people perform without a conductor and they just listen very carefully to each other. But in terms of the actual experience of singing, it's not different.
I mean, I don't know how often you might find yourself in a kind of community setting where you're singing with other people. I mean, have you done as much in recent memory?
Well, only as I described. I don't sing in a chorus ever. I mean, not since I was a kid, let's put it that way.
Right. Okay. What I'm hoping to get to is I heard you talking about, I guess that it was a dinner party you'd attended with Francis Collins, or maybe is that where you met him?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And am I correct that you actually led a sing-along that included several Supreme Court justices?
We did. That was a quite extraordinary experience. And Francis brought his guitar. That just seemed like the right thing to do after a hard day. They had just decided marriage equality that day. And it was a tense environment because obviously they didn't all agree. But they were gracious, and they were so extraordinary because they're used to disagreeing and vociferously and also eloquently and then still getting along. You know, Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg were all, he's passed away, but they're very great friends. So let this be a lesson to us in our time of political division that we can disagree, we can agree to disagree. So it was a beautiful thing actually for Francis to bring his guitar, and we just started singing some of these terrific songs that everyone knew, This Land Is Your Land, and you know, The Times They Are a Changin' was the most interesting choice.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself scanning the room to see who was participating?
Well, there was only a small group of people, so we were all together. It was 10 people, I think. And it was special. It was very special.
I mean, that counts as community singing in my book, Renee.
You know, it's anything that's a group, if you're family, if you're singing together at the holidays, certainly churches. You know, I grew up singing in church choir. My father was a choral conductor. So all of that. And now, of course, I applaud when I see this incredible music therapist named Tom Schweitzer in Virginia, who has a stroke choir. So people who've suffered from a stroke sing together.
Oh, wow.
And these are very healthy, wonderful activities for community, for developing community, and for also for healing, for allowing the brain to exercise its plasticity, which is something we're all very excited about now.
Singing, period, or singing with other people?
Well, both. I mean, singing with other people and developing community is so important. But singing, period, is another, you're using language and you're also You know, people who have had traumatic brain injury or who have regained speech or stroke, they've regained speech from singing. It's one of my favorites.
So this may be a good opportunity for me to ask you, was it at this dinner party that you spoke with Dr. Collins and you decided to begin this initiative, or had it started before then?
So I was new as artistic advisor at large at the Kennedy Center, and I said, wouldn't it be great if these two national institutions work together to, we'd like to provide a platform for science for your work. Mm-hmm. As he's a terrific musician, so he understood intrinsically that music in the brain has tremendous possibilities. And there was a lot of research already starting. So he's been incredibly committed to supporting these efforts. And in fact, the NIH gave a sizable grant to music in the brain research just recently.
Oh, cool. Well, he certainly has his hands full right now, I would imagine.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, I don't, somebody said to me today, they don't think he's slept in weeks.
Oh my God. Is he based in DC?
Yes. Yes. So the NIH and the CDC, they all work very closely together, and they're all, and he runs the NIH. So it's a huge responsibility.
And so could you talk a bit more about why it was you were inspired to, you know, assume this mantle of public health advocacy or getting more resources driven towards this intersection of music and science and neuroscience specifically?
Well, first of all, it fascinates me as a musician. It's something you always, you know, in singers, what we do is so complicated because we're using involuntary muscles. We can't even see what we're doing. It's internal. And so the mind-body connection was something I was very curious about from a young age, because at that time, medicine was kind of denying that that existed. So in just those couple of decades now, of course, it's definitely accepted. But I just thought, I felt like the audience, the general public, should know more about the health benefits of music for childhood development, for all of the therapies. Binhu's work with Parkinson's patients is so inspiring, incredibly inspiring. And the fact that he's developed an app that could treat, you know, hundreds of thousands of people at once is amazing. So just to meet someone like Ben is to me extremely exciting, because it informs my work as a singer. And it's also something that I love to share with my audience, and they are fascinated by it.
Ben, could you speak to some of the work that you're doing with music and Parkinson's and the app you developed?
Parkinson's responding to music is a phenomenon that was actually first, I would say, formally documented by Oliver Sacks. You know the name, you know,
yes.
The Awakening, yeah, in New York. So actually we met in Calgary when he came here. So I talked about my work, and actually he was extremely interested. He asked me to carry on. So actually I did. You know, in the past 15 years, this is mainly my work, music and the brain in Parkinson's. It's called Ambulosonal. It's a program where patients, Parkinson patients, they put an iPod on their leg, so they start to walk. So they use their leg to bring out the music. It's almost like use your leg to play piano. You know, this is actually, it's not like a speculative work. So there's a very solid science about how the music can affect the brain area that controls walking. Okay, so this connection from the music area in the brain to the area that controls walking is a phenomenon actually, and you can see when they hear a piece of music using the PET brain imaging, that area controls walking is light up regardless whether you move or not. Okay, so we don't know why, but I suspect it's because of in the animal world, you can't see very much because of the trees or whatever. So the sound actually is the primary cue that you use to pray or to escape. So that's why this is a very old brain network. So what happened in Parkinson's is that, you know, as Oliver Sacks noted, that some of these patients, they can't walk, but they can dance. Actually, they can dance perfectly. A few years ago, actually, there was an earthquake in Italy. So there's Parkinson patients, they escape from their residence faster than anybody else. Okay, so then why under certain conditions, for example, like this called the motor urgency, or with music, they suddenly can move. This is just an anecdotal observation, but what we did is that we used this particular phenomenon to create a technology. So basically, you can use either an iPod or a sensor that wrapped on your leg. Okay, so the patients will walk, but you can set the size of their steps. So they only walk faster or larger steps, the music will play. Okay, so they learn this and over and over again. So then their brain created a new pathway. Okay, so because we usually do not use our leg to control music. You know, this is similar to a pianist. So you learn to play piano over time, your finger movement become very fluid. So now you put this music player on your leg, and then you use your leg to control the music play. So what we found out actually, exactly, precisely as we predicted, there's the left side of the walking speed control area shows very dramatic change. This is after 6 months. What is more interesting is that all these patients, once they have gone through this over a period of 2 years, gait function and then their overall motor function improved dramatically. Okay, so their clinical progression seems slowed.
So you had observed that Parkinson's patients could dance without visible tremors. Is that the case?
Okay, so not all of them. Okay, some of them, if they do not have their medications on,
right.
Okay, they can barely stand up. They can barely walk. Mm-hmm. They can't. But once the music is on, they can dance with a perfect dancing step. Okay. So this is like a motor memory.
Okay.
If you ask these patients, you know, you have to have the music they're really familiar with, and especially one who have been dancing with before. Music-related motor memory that is in their brain is permanently stored there. It doesn't go away when they have Parkinson's. So it's almost like a reserve.
And are you telling me that there is observable skill, like you wouldn't be able to tell that they have Parkinson's? They're dancing that well and that fluidly?
Some. Few. Not many. Okay.
There's a beautiful documentary. Mark Morris's dance and his dance troupe have started a program that's now international. And the documentary is called Capturing Grace.
Yes.
And it really shows how this works. And Bin Hu, of course, knows the science, and he's created something that can treat more people quickly. But these motor issues that develop with certain disorders can be treated really well with music. You know, again, if it's this, or if it's a brain injury or stroke, suddenly people can regain skill, and the music helps the brain make connections that it wasn't making. And it's really extraordinary.
And is this similar to how someone who might have a really debilitating stutter, how they can sing perfectly
exactly.
but can't speak?
Exactly. It's the same kind of thing. Exactly. You're using a different part of the brain. You're accessing another part of the brain that enables a certain skill.
Did you see the Bill Withers documentary?
No.
It's incredibly moving. And just to see him, I mean.
Oh, I'm writing that down.
Just to see him interact with, I think he visits a school of kids who have stutters. And I mean, he had a stutter. And so he was able to sing. But they go into that.
I'm writing that. But I mean, just like if you talk about musicians, Glenn Campbell, you think about also, you know, how he was able with Alzheimer's disease to play music, play and sing really late into his disease. And that it's the last memory to go, musical memory in patients. And I saw that myself with my husband's aunt. And the last year of her life, she could only sing songs.
Wow.
So this is why science wants to look at this.
Yeah. And music is also giving neuroscientists kind of side door access to understanding more things about the brain separate from music, correct?
Right.
Is that right?
Right. And I would say the therapists translate the information directly to the patient when there's an intervention, a therapeutic intervention. And but in the meantime, scientists are really interested in understanding why these things work. I mean, Francis Collins says it really well, you know, about that the Brain Institute is a relatively new division at the NIH, and that's, they're looking at anything and everything that affects the brain, and science has proven that music is quite powerful. Yeah. My take on that from kind of working and seeing these different presentations for a couple of years is that it has to be evolution. This has to, back to Sapiens, this has to do with the fact that we practice social cohesion and communicated very often with musical sounds for much of human history. And modern history is a speck on that.
You know, for the show, we were just interviewing an acoustician to talk about the physics of sound. And, you know, I mean, sound is the first sense that you use to take inventory of your surroundings. And how he pointed out that when we see lightning, we observe it and it doesn't necessarily cause us to panic. Though when we hear thunder, that is what really inspires fear. And it's the lightning that's actually physically threatening to us, not the thunder. Yet it's the thunder that we hear and that's what causes the fear.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And he attributes that to, you know, our lizard brain having to respond quickly to something in our environment, be it a rattling snake at our feet, for example, or...
Right. Dinosaurs.
Exactly. I know. you had mentioned one of the things that you were interested in was music and child development. Could I ask you to speak to that?
Well, there are a number of studies now that are excellent, and it's been proven that children who play an instrument, for instance, this is mostly valuable for a child who is playing and learning how to play an instrument. And it's something about the eye, ear, and hand coordination working together that really does help develop the brain. And of course, we know that you have to have discipline and that you have to have focus to excel at something so complex. And for children in the lower socioeconomic status, it's even more beneficial. They can really improve. It takes a couple of years, but it does make a big difference. So I highly recommend it. I mean, we want all of the senses, you know, as many senses as possible working. And they're using music now with autism treatment and autism research successfully.
I mean, I know in the last 20 years is funding for public education has continued to run dry, that it's the arts programs are the first to go. But with the rise in autism statistics, have you seen a turnaround at all?
Well, certainly for autism programs, music is very much a powerful part of that. As somebody said, there was a very compelling presentation in Hong Kong when I was there in October, and Ben, you were with me, and it was a woman who works with autistic children who said, in many cases, these children have a terrible time communicating with words, but they can communicate with music. She was showing examples of children really enjoying themselves, whether it's drumming or experience. It's an experiential way of learning that can be very useful when you're dealing with children who have developmental problems or dealing with any kind of learning disability. Music is something that, I mean, you never have gone to a town center and seen a band play and not watched every young child dance or move or bob. It is such a basic human response. Again, I think owing to evolution. It's joy in that moment, the response.
Yeah. Also, I mean, earlier we were talking about the power of singing music together and, you know, the opportunities for healing that might invite as well.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I think Julian Johnson in California has done a major study with chorus singing. And I haven't had a chance to meet her or to look at this, but I'm sure it's excellent. I know there was one in London, in the UK, that said that singing in a choir improves your immune system. So we love that, especially now, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, the godfather of communal singing, Pete Seeger, he was always encouraging his audiences to sing together, you know, and he would actually, I saw footage of his 90th birthday at the Garden, and they're doing Amazing Grace. And he's like, okay, now you people in the mezzanine, you're going to take the alto part. Here's your note. And then here's the tenor note up here, you know, and then he gets everyone to sing together. He pointed out that, you know, not everyone can sing on key, but if you get a big crowd to sing together, they can sing on key. And I think that there's, that makes a very,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it makes a very powerful statement. And I think it does a lot of things. It encourages people to overcome some fears, because singing is frightening, especially if you don't do it every day. And
right.
I read somewhere that you actually had your own relationship to stage fright somewhere in your career.
Oh, I did. Absolutely. You know, a couple of times, and it is really a challenge. And we know lots of incredibly famous people who've stepped away from their careers for 5 to 20 years mm-hmm. because of it. So I had a rough year the last time I had it, but I hung in there. It's better if you keep going.
And just push through it.
So you push through. And ultimately, I had to see the audience rather than seeing them as a judging body, but to see me as a sharing body. Mm. And that made a huge difference. Just thinking about it differently.
Wow. So it was like a mindfulness practice?
No, it was more an attitude. It was more of changing. Again, there's so much that we make decisions about things, decide that they're hard or decide that I can't do this yeah. or whatever decisions we make, we can unmake and decide to think about it in a different way. So that helped. Understanding too, that by nature, I was a shy person and not gregarious. I didn't have a natural performer's personality. Mm. You know, I had to kind of unpack all of those things.
Okay. And this is well into your career after you've had tremendous success, correct?
Yes. In fact, you could even call it a success conflict. I wrote about that in my book, The Inner Voice, because I thought this isn't something I've heard other people talk about. And we see it happen. People who achieve amazing success, but success that brings them so far away from their roots that they sabotage it subconsciously.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's through drugs and alcohol or sex or, you know, there's so many ways we've seen it with Hollywood stars, with politicians, mm-hmm. people will often develop a deep discomfort.
Yeah. And then so your ability to kind of unravel that speaks to neural plasticity, right? That these are things that you can undo or retrain.
Yes. And, tracks of thinking, you know, habits of thinking can be destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose for cognitive behavioral therapy is to examine them and say, should I really be thinking this 10 times a day? That helped me a lot too, discovering that mode of psychology.
Wow. That's very powerful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yes.
Before we close, I want to say to you, Renee, what's so cool to me about your spearheading this work is, you know, dare I say it, opera is not the most accessible form of music. It requires training, it requires technique, and it's not often the case that you can see it performed outside of cities. And it's one thing for a protest singer with a banjo like Pete Seeger to encourage everybody to sing together, but for an opera singer like you to stump for promoting the benefits of doing as much, I find uniquely powerful. So I want to thank you for doing this work.
Oh, thank you. That's great. I appreciate that. Well, I'm glad you're a musician. So where are you based, Matt?
Upstate New York, just outside Cooperstown.
Oh, beautiful. Well, you should go to Glimmerglass.
Oh, I have. And we went during a huge rainstorm. And you know that opera house has a metal roof. And so...
Oh, dear. Oh, forget it.
It was beautiful, though. I mean, it was it was so thunderous and
right.
It was exciting.
Okay. That's neat.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me. And I hope you are able to stay safe and healthy.
Thank you. And you too.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Be sure to check out Music in the Mind Live with Renee Fleming, a new online webinar series on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern. You can tune in at youtube.com/the Kennedy Center. The series will explore the powerful impact of music in the arts on human health and the brain. Guests will include former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin, world-famous author Deepak Chopra, and more. Sing for Science is co-produced by The Talkhouse. Our intro and exit music is by Italian artist Panoram. Please be sure to check out our other episodes and subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening.